funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Brian Garner. He is the editor-in-chief of Black's Law Dictionary. He has several new books out, including Garner's Modern American Usage, Garner on Language and Writing, and co-written with Justice Antonin Scalia, Making Your Case, The Art of Persuading Judges. If you want to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. And Brian, you have another quiz for us.
Yes.
All right.
Our two quiz, three word choice points. What is the preferred form, preventative or preventive?
Okay.
Number two, what is the preferred form for the plural of mother-in-law? Should it be mothers-in-law or mother-in-laws?
Okay.
And number three, on word choice, what is the correct expression? Let he who is without sin cast the first stone, or let him who is without sin cast the first stone. Let he or him who is without sin cast the first stone. So those are the word choice points. And then we have three pronunciation points. The U.S. Supreme Court, when it accepts review, grants cert. But what is the full word for cert? How do you say it? There's a certain flower.
I do know how to spell it, but that's not going to help me this
time.
Yeah,
yeah. How do you finish cert? You can understand why people wanted to shorten it. What is the flower that begins with glad, and how do you say it? Okay. Now, you can understand why people shorten that to glads, as Dame Edna always talks about her glads. But how do you say that word? And there's a certain Christmas flower that begins with poin.
Mm-hmm.
And how is that word pronounced?
All right. Okay, we will find the answers to this at the end of the hour. And thank you last hour for reminding me, because I think I would have blown right past this. I want to talk for just a minute about this new book that you wrote with Justice Scalia. First of all, I suppose we can figure The Art of Persuading Judges as the subtitle. We can figure what this is about. But tell us a little bit about the content of the book.
Well, it's all about persuasion and how advocates can persuade judges. And it's not just about appellate courts. It's about family law courts and district courts and any court of appeal, state or federal. But the idea was to look at all the literature from Aristotle on. A lot of the ancients had some great ideas about how advocates persuade judges. But in fact, many non-lawyers have read the book and said they've really enjoyed it. There are a lot of reviews of it on Amazon, for example, where people say, I'm not a lawyer, but I found this fascinating, just to find out how to persuade people. It's about logic, and it's about writing good briefs, and it's about speech, how to talk so that people will find you credible.
Now, to most of us mere mortals, it would seem daunting to sit down and write a book with a Supreme Court justice. Is Scalia an affable guy?
Oh, extremely affable. We have a great time together. We really love our sessions together. We probably, once we had a draft of the book last, 18 months ago, we probably spent, we've calculated 80 to 100 hours together working through sentence by sentence. The way we wrote the book, by the way, was that each of us wrote independently each of the 115 sections, and then I combined what he wrote with what I wrote, and it was amazing how the literary styles just came together nicely.
So he's not a legalese sort of writer?
Not at all, no. But none of the judges that I know and respect love legal. I've never actually met a judge who loves legalese. Judges are very impatient, typically, with puffed-up jargon. They want straight talk, and they want to know certain things about the case. They don't want their time wasted, and jargon is a way of wasting time.
Brian Garner is my guest. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Bhaskar who asks, which is correct, are you coming or are you going?
Well, it depends. If you're asking about a party that's being held at your house, it's kind of like bring and take, come and go. Mm-hmm. And if you're at your house, you'd say, are you coming? Are you coming toward me? But if you're talking about a party at a third person's house, are you going? I'm thinking of going. It's not toward you. It's away from you. Then it's going to be going.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. David has been waiting so patiently in Irving. Hello, David.
Hey, Chris. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
What's up, Brian?
Not much.
How are you guys doing?
Great. Thank you.
Well, good.
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Okay. Question. Ex-girlfriend of mine, who was a writer for one of the local college newspapers, she and I had a discussion regarding searching for things like keys, pants. When she found them, she would say, those are they. Brian, have you ever heard that, or what context? I mean, when would that be appropriate to use?
This has nothing to do with why she became an ex-girlfriend.
That's what I said earlier. It has nothing to do with that. Of course not.
Well, the only time I've ever heard that used was when I used it, jokingly. It is technically correct. Nobody would... Most people colloquially would say, those are them, not those are they. It is I, it is we. It's we is actually, in some hyper-formal way, correct. But I, to the extent that I've ever used it, is always with tongue-in-cheek.
So when you call your daughters, you don't say, it is I, your father.
No, I don't. I hope they'll recognize the voice.
Let's go next on the line to Bill in Dallas. Hey, Bill.
Hey. Hey, I just want to throw out three expressions that drive me nuts. It sounds like kids talking on the playground. Two of them is pushback and takeaway, which you hear all the time. And then parse has been around for a long time, but I think it's way overused. But I got another one I want to know if you've ever heard of. I've actually heard in two regions of the country people talking about someone behaving, but they talk about them being have. I want to know if you had ever heard that.
My goodness, I've never heard that. Have you, Chris?
Being haved, no.
No.
Probably because I rarely do it.
I wonder if it's a joke. But pushback and takeaway, yeah, those are, I would say, vogue terms. Parse is, of course, a grammatical term originally. We had to parse sentences when you diagram a sentence, you're parsing it. But increasingly that became popularized into just figuring out what somebody was saying, parsing somebody's language.
We have an email here from Lee in San Antonio who writes, it would seem to me there is a Britishification of U.S. English going on. I particularly mark the disappearance of disappeared in favor of gone missing.
Yes, there are. I've got a significant entry in modern American usage about Americanisms and Britishisms, and that one actually seems to be an Australianism, that gone missing came into the language, I think, with Crocodile Dundee. I believe that's what the...
Australification of English.
I had to research this a good deal, but that seems to have taken fire caught fire with Crocodile Dundee.
We'll go next on the line to Leonard in Dallas. Hi, Leonard.
Hi,
go ahead, please.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead, please.
Okay, two things. First, my grandmother, born 1893, a literate and educated woman, taught me that one should not say, I do not think you should call her, versus you should say, I think you should not call her. And the second thing is Obama's transparency, does that equate to eschew obfuscation?
Well, this idea about don't think, I don't think, is... certainly something that usage writers have considered. It was thought, certainly in the 1920s and 1930s, that you shouldn't say, I don't think you should do this, as opposed to, I think you shouldn't do this, because you are actually thinking. But the idiom is pretty well ensconced now. I would call it a stage 5 misusage. It's eccentric today to object to it. But she was true to her time if she was born in 1893 to object vehemently to it.
And the second question about transparency?
Oh, eschew obfuscation. Well, I think there's a movement afoot in government to try to draft better statutes and to promulgate better rules and regulations, but it's a perennial struggle. And I know it's something that Senator John Cornyn takes a lot of interest in, but I just wish there were more evidence of that in Congress and in Austin as well.
Brian Garner is my guest this hour. We are continuing our conversation with him. We will continue our conversation with him in a few minutes. Right now, we're going to take a quick break for fundraising purposes. Jeff Whittington, senior producer of the show, has joined us in the studio. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Things are going rather well. We've heard from many of you, Michael Raglan and Scurry, Texas. Thank you
Scurry.
Very much, Michael. Sandra Cook and Farmers Branch, Pong Brewer and Irving, Wendy King in Dallas, Tabrez, Lalani and Euless, Kendra Stevenson in Flower Mound, and Dr. Evan Bates in Dallas, and also Debbie Siebert in Caddo Mills. Thanks so much for your calls to 800-456-5372 or your online contributions at kera.org.
It is easy to make a contribution to the station. You decide what it's worth to you to have this sort of programming in your community available to you 365 days a year. If you listen to KERA and you've listened to other stations in the market, you know that our service is unduplicated. There is nowhere else you can turn on the broadcast dial in this market and hear programming anything like what we bring to you. There's nothing wrong with what else exists out there, but there is a difference in how they are funded. We get our money directly from people who listen to the station. More than half of our budget comes from listeners who say, all right, I love KERA. I can do $5 or $10 or $20 a month. I can support the station because it matters to me.
1-800-456-5372 is the number to dial to do that. And when you join the station today, we have some thank you gifts to offer. We have a very special, very limited supply of a couple of books that Brian Garner brought in today. We have two copies of Black's Law Dictionary's 9th edition, just out, and they're both autographed. And you can get one of those if you join the station right now at the $350 membership level at 800-456-KERA. We have two copies of Making Your Case, The Art of Persuading Judges, that's co-written by Justice Antonin Scalia and Brian Garner, and they're both autographed by both authors.
Both of these books, sorry to keep using this word over and over, strike me as the perfect gift for that attorney in your life who means a lot to you but has the resources to buy whatever he or she might want. And you always try to think, what would the perfect gift be? And it's really hard sometimes.
Sure.
You know? There's only so many fancy pens you can give somebody. But these would be a fantastic, really personal thing to give someone.
And they're each available at the $500 membership level. So do your part right now at 800-456-5372. You could take home your very own autographed copy of Making Your Case by Antonin Scalia and Brian Garner. And we also have the 3rd edition just out of Modern American Usage at the $225 membership level today. And we also have Garner on Language and Writing available for your $120 contribution.
1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number. You can also go online and make a contribution at kera.org. We are proud to be able to bring you great substantive conversations. Today, we even have 2 hours. Usually, we do 1 hour per topic. Even an hour is remarkable in today's media climate. It's remarkable to have an audience like you that wants it and pays attention to it, and remarkable to have many of you who decide to pay for it because it matters that much.
It is your public radio station, and as Chris said, where else are you going to find 2 hours on language, grammar, and usage? And, you know, this is a station that even has a weekly hour or a weekly show that's an hour long on words, Away with Words. It airs on Friday. So we know that these topics are important to you and that you really enjoy these conversations. So we hope that you will support these programs and this kind of programming by calling 800-456-5372 or contributing online at kera.org.
If we have mentioned something throughout this hour or the last and you're interested in it as a thank you gift and you didn't quite catch the guidelines for that, just ask the person on the phone. They will have all the information for you. You can also find a lot of this online at kera.org. We will be back in just a minute with Brian Garner.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Black's Law Dictionary Editor-in-Chief Brian Garner. His recent books include the third edition of Garner's Modern American Usage, Garner on Language and Writing, and Making Your Case, The Art of Persuading Judges, written with Justice Antonin Scalia. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Diana, who identifies herself as a transplanted Brit. Is there such a phrase as short-lived? I have argued with a literate friend over this. I believe it's short-lived. I hear the first one said a lot in Texas, but this friend isn't even a Texan.
Well, the traditional term is short-lived. It means having a short life. It would be like saying a many-wived man, as opposed to, for a polygamous man, I guess, as opposed to
many-lived.
Yeah. So it actually comes from the noun life. Having a long life is long-lived. And short-lived and long-lived are considered not quite as proper usage. I think it is partly influenced, in the UK anyway, by Long Live the Queen.
Huh.
Long-lived.
Long-lived, yeah. Short-lived. Huh. Very interesting. I've always said, I have to say, I've said short-lived, and now I'm going to have to change everything.
Well, on this particular one, one never knows what to say, because if you say long-lived, which is what I almost always say, there are going to be people raise their eyebrows. Fortunately for me, people who know me tend not to raise their eyebrows.
They're afraid to.
But if you're in a certain group, I can see saying long-lived, especially if somebody else has just used the word. Because if you hear somebody else use a word and then you use it differently or pronounce it differently, it sort of draws attention to the fact that you're either correcting the person or that you disagree with the way the person said it.
That actually comes up sometimes on this radio show. Someone will pronounce a term in a different way, and if I've already said it and then they say it differently, I always struggle in my mind with whether to convert over to what they've just said.
On the other hand, if you have somebody talking about a philosopher and saying...
Nietzsche?
That's exactly what I was thinking of. Nietzsche. Or
I can't do that.
Nietzsche.
I can't go there.
You wouldn't repeat that, I don't think.
No, I'm a Nietzsche girl. All right, we have an email here from Rollins who says his pet peeve is complected instead of complexioned. Is that becoming accepted?
It's becoming, but not there yet.
Stage three?
Complected is stage three.
Uh-huh. So there's hope?
Well, I think there is hope. By the time something gets to stage three, some will say it's inevitable. I will not be the first to cave in. I'll typically be one of the last 5% of the holdouts, before ultimately saying it's time to pack it in and give up the fight. For example, self-deprecating, which is now standard American English, even though traditionally it was always supposed to be self-depreciating. To belittle yourself is to depreciate yourself. One meaning of depreciate is to belittle. So self-deprecating began as a mistake, but today everybody, 99.9% of the time in print, it's self-deprecating. In American English, the Brits still tend to say self-depreciative.
You know, I've never even heard that. So I suppose I'm a victim of stage four and beyond.
Maybe.
Let's go next to Dan in Dallas. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Great show today.
Thank you.
My question is, I'm an English professor, and my students' papers, about 80% of them, I get a verb that I don't personally use, but... that's to reference, as in Shakespeare referenced Chaucer, or something like that. And I always use to refer to, but I'm wondering if there's any validity at all to using the verb to reference.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I wonder what stage I mark that as. I'm with you. I like refer as a verb and prefer not to use reference as a transitive verb at all. I wouldn't say referencing, but... let's see, reference for refer. I call it stage four, so that's very far on its way toward being, some would say it's already acceptable American English. But for an English professor to make that correction is, I think, obligatory for the time being.
We have an email here from Summer. This is a good one for you. What is the correct pronunciation of the word that means attorney? Lawyer or lawyer?
Say the two again.
Lawyer or lawyer? Lawyer sounds more Texas to me.
Well, I think those are both acceptable pronunciations. And I say lawyer. I say the second one. But lawyer is a little bit overpronounced. But I feel certain that you would have highly educated Americans in different parts of the country using each of those pronunciations. That's a very subtle difference, it seems to me.
You think it's a dialect thing as opposed to...
A little bit. There are slight regional variations. For example, I grew up in the panhandle of Texas, and in my native speech, I do not differentiate between P-E-N and P-I-N.
Pencil.
Well, I say pencil, and I say pen, whether it's something I write with or something that somebody would button on. So for me to differentiate between those two, and I certainly can say pen and pin, is I have to think about it, and it's kind of an affectation. In my natural speech, and I think in most Texans' natural speech, and for that matter, anybody in our speech community, which runs all the way up from through Missouri and up through parts of the Midwest, it is not natural to distinguish those tones. On the other hand, I have some pronunciation expert friends who just think that is abominable, that I don't distinguish between the two. But my ear doesn't hear it. In the same way that a non-native speaker, say, of Chinese or any tone language is not going to hear the tones in quite the same way as somebody who was brought up with those tonal distinctions.
Let's go next to Euless, where we find Steve. Hello, Steve.
Oh, thank you very much. That's a wonderful show, and happy pledge drive. I am a member and a snoot in training.
Thank you.
My grandmother taught in a one-room schoolhouse, and she tried her best to teach me about my Latin roots. And my two pet peeves, which are probably stage five to ten, are decimate and terrific. And she used to refer to the earthquakes in California as being absolutely terrific, referring back to the terror root. So those are my two pet peeves. And tell me what stage they are, Brian. Pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for your call, Steve.
Yeah, that's a very old-fashioned view of terrific, to think that you would refer to an earthquake that maybe destroyed lives as being terrific, meaning that it struck terror in the hearts of the people. That's probably not idiomatic English today. On the decimate question, that's a complicated answer, because today it is probably stage five to use decimate in the sense of widespread destruction. Traditionally, with the Roman legions, it was destroying one-tenth of the army was to decimate it. And that is the etymology of the word decimate, the D-E-C-I meaning one-tenth of. So widespread, large-scale destruction, that's stage five. It is not, however, good usage to say decimate when you're referring to complete destruction. So to say, for example, that Hiroshima was decimated by the atomic bomb, that's really probably not good usage. I would call that stage three in reference to complete destruction. Now, somebody's going to argue that Hiroshima was not completely destroyed, but...
We'll handle that in another show about the Second World War.
And then to use decimate in reference to the figurative destruction of only a single person, she was decimated by the news, that's probably stage four. It's large-scale destruction, but it's a little bit odd. And then to say decimate when you mean hamper or plague, that problem decimates me, that is probably stage two or three. That's not very good. But that particular verb, as you can see, creates a good many usage issues.
Let's go to a question that I think you will have two answers to. This is an email. I don't have a name. Has it become acceptable to end a sentence with a preposition? The second part of this is, it seems to me that everyone says, where's it at?
Well, those are, in fact, two answers. It is not good English to say, where is it at? But the problem is not that it ends with a preposition. For example, you can say, what hotel are you at? Which is fine. What hotel are you at? The problem with where are you at, which is dialectal usage, is that the idea of place is in this word where, which we call a locative. And where are you at is redundant, but that is a speech marker that typifies uneducated speech. Now, I grant you, there are some college-educated people that I know who say, where is it at? I can't help thinking a little less of them each time. I wonder, probably I shouldn't think this way, Chris, but my goodness, do you not read much? Where are you is good English, and what hotel is it at? Or what would you put up with that for? That's fine to end with a preposition, and it's always been fine in English. Preposition is a Latin term. Of course, etymologically, it means prepositioned, positioned before. And some people have tried to argue that that applies to English as well. Every serious grammarian over the last three centuries has conceded that prepositions often need to be at the end of a sentence.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We will hold off on our next round of calls until we get through some fundraising. Jeff Whittington is joining us now. Brian Garner is our guest for these 2 hours of Think, which is good because I think, Jeff, we could go another two or three and not get through the stack of emails and the list of callers
online. We could
do a week
of these shows. I mean, this is it's overwhelming, the amount. I mean, I'm used to this on Friday, these kinds of stacks of email, but you keep looking at me and
it's too much.
Well, here's one email that I really want to share. The greatness of Susan Krasno has written us, and she says, the five stages of asking Brian Garner a grammar question. Number one, umbrage at the way non-snoots are destroying the English language. Number two, hope that Garner will validate your umbrage. Three, trepidation about the possibility that you will make a grammatical faux pas in wording your question. I've got my hand up there. Four, enlightenment. You get your answer. And five, humility, when you realize you've been wrong all these years.
Very nicely put, Susan. Thank you.
So thank you so much, Susan.
Susan Krasno is great.
Well, we would love to hear from many more of you at the other number, 800-456-5372. And I want to remind everybody that we have these very special thank you gifts available. We have two copies of Making Your Case, The Art of Persuading Judges, written by Brian Garner, who's our guest, and Judge Justice Antonin Scalia. These are autographed copies. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia himself has signed these copies, and they are each available to the first two people who call and join the station at the $500 membership level.
The signed copy is not the one that's sitting in front of
me.
No one
not.
Wants to trust me with the
No, I turned those over
with
to the
super
authorities.
Valuable copies.
I turned those over to the authorities right away. And we also have two brand new copies of Black's Law Dictionary, the 9th edition, edited by Brian Garner. Those are available when you join at the $350 membership level. We've heard from many of you, and many of you are taking advantage of Garner on Language and Writing at the $120 level, or third edition of Modern American Usage at the $225 level. These are resources that you're going to use and consult over and over and over again if you do anything, if you have anything to do with writing. And actually, as Chris said earlier, they're actually really interesting to read.
They really are. You can learn a lot. And the great thing about reading Brian's work is that, you know, I like to think that I know my way around the English language. And it is good to be, as Susan put it, humbled a little bit and realize that we all have work to do. 1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number if you want to take advantage of any of these thank you gift offers. If you just want to make a straight gift to KERA, run to the bookstore so there's no waiting for your new copy of the third edition of Modern American Usage or any of these other books. You can also get to us online at kera.org. Your contribution, you can hear exactly what it pays for. You don't have to wonder when you make a contribution to KERA, when you make a donation, where your money is being spent, because you listen to it every day. I mean, you can come down here, you know, we have an office building and
sure,
we have staplers and expenses and light bills and all that, but really the heart and soul of the way we spend your money is devoted to the programming.
Yeah, you hear it every day. You hear the microphones, you hear the equipment that all of this runs through to get to your radio so that you can consume and use the product. And no matter what it is that you like about KERA, that is the reason to support the station. This station relies on your contributions to pay for over half of the bills. You know, a bill comes in and it has to be paid. And those programming bills from NPR are $1 million a year, $1 million plus a year. And those have to be paid every year, or you don't get Morning Edition. You don't get the Diane Rehm Show. We wouldn't be able to broadcast Fresh Air. So your call right now does, of course, and we really appreciate it right now because it's during the Think Show, it does help pay for the Think programming and all of the other programming that you hear on KERA.
And you may not be aware that the way we are charged for the national programming that feeds through KERA is according to the size of our audience. So if you think to yourself, well, I'm just sitting out here listening, I'm not costing anybody anything.
Right.
The truth is, actually, the bigger the audience, the more you pay. That's why, you know, in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, they don't have to pay as much for NPR content as we pay here in North Texas. It seems only fair, but it also requires that you recognize that you are, in fact, you are, as a listener, a part of our expense base.
You are, and we're thrilled that you're listening, and more of you are finding the station every day. We know that thousands of people move to North Texas every month, and if you were a member or listened to a public radio station or supported that station somehow where you used to live, well, we're thrilled to have you in North Texas now. We're thrilled to have you as a listener, but we're asking you to take responsibility for the fact that you're listening to KERA now by calling 800-456-5372. And don't forget, very limited, very special, two copies of Making Your Case, signed, autographed copies by author Antonin Scalia and co-author Brian Garner. And also we have two autographed copies of the new edition, the ninth edition of Black's Law Dictionary. Those are available at the $350 level, the Making Your Case autographed copies, each available at the $500 membership level. I'm shocked that if they're not gone yet, because this would make a fantastic gift for your litigator friend or family member.
For the litigator in your life.
That's right.
Telephone number is 1-800-456-5372. If you're interested in the signed books that we've talked about, those need to those transactions need to take place over the phone. If you are wanting a copy of Garner on Language and Writing or Garner's Modern American Usage, the brand new third edition, those you can obtain when you make your contribution online or on the phone. Online, we are at kera.org. The telephone number is 1-800-456-5372.
And don't forget, your online contributions are just as easy for us to tally and add into the about $156,000 left to raise. Would love to break through that $150,000 barrier by the end of the hour. So please call 800-456-5372. Please go online to kera.org, and thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is language expert Brian Garner. We have many calls and emails that we'll probably never get to this hour, so I'm going to go into this as fast as possible. Colette writes, when is it okay to use on behalf of, and when is it okay to use in behalf of? I was telling Brian before the break, this is something that I have to look up every time I have to use this phrase.
Well, it's a very, very close distinction. But in behalf of means for the benefit of. So he fought in behalf of the man's reputation. For the benefit of, or in the interest of. Lawyers act in behalf of their clients. On behalf of means as the agent of, or as the representative of. So on behalf of the Garden Club, I would like to thank our luncheon speaker, that sort of thing.
There you go. Quick and easy.
Yeah.
All right, let's go next to Kevin in Burleson. Hey, Kevin.
Yes, ma'am. Chris, thank you. Brian, I'm a Yankee, moved to Texas, and one thing that has really got to me is when we walk into a restaurant and they say, how are you guys doing? And it seems to be a standard reference, and there is no gender deflection there.
Oh, I see. Guys. You guys, yeah.
And so, hi, y'all, was always the was the local saying. And so now I just want to know, I would just as soon prefer hi, y'all, or howdy, as to hi, guys.
Well, I agree with you. I don't like... I was sitting with my co-author at a restaurant, and his wife and my fiancé, and the waiter came up and said, how are you guys doing? Now, there's something that seems to me, maybe he didn't know that it was a justice of the Supreme Court sitting there, but you guys, that's over-familiar. On the other hand, in many parts of the country, you guys... Well, they don't have the benefit of the Texas y'all.
There's
y'all
no
is
substitute.
It's a wonderful little term, y'all, because it's a plural for you. And most parts of America struggle with that. Nobody's comfortable with use guys. But you guys may be all right. Now, sometimes you can joshingly say you guys, which a guy has become a gender-neutral term. I was giving a speech in New York not long ago and jokingly said to a group of lawyers, you guys, so-and-so. And one of the elderly practitioners in the back of the room stood up and raised his hand and said, now, Mr. Garner, you said you guys, and you don't seem to be recognizing that there are many women in the room. Shouldn't you have said guys and gals? And that really provoked laughter from the group, because there's no way that somebody of my generation can say guys and gals.
It's straight out of 1941.
It is. I think he could have gotten away with it being...
also out of 1941.
He was a nonagenarian in his early 90s. But I think it would be very difficult for... a younger person to say, not that I'm young, but to say guys and gals.
Now, I'm guessing I already know what you're going to say about this, but occasionally you'll hear people say, y'all need to pick up y'all's towels before you come in this house. There's a possessive added to the word y'all.
Yeah, that's dialectal, y'alls. I would not say that, but you do hear it, and I would wager that among college-educated people, it's much less common than it is among people who don't have a college education. I mean, it's a shame to have this linguistic stratification of society.
Do you really believe that?
I do. I think it is. I really think it is. But it's real. It exists. And I wish it didn't exist. I mean, I think that's what education is all about, is to enable everyone to speak good English.
What about the phrase whole nother?
That's a whole nother question. Do you know what that's called when you... I love to collect terms like this, Chris. Rhetorical terms for putting another word in the middle of a word. So another becomes a whole nother, or there are many of them with curse words in the middle.
Oh, sure.
Absolutely, that sort of thing. That is called mesis. T-M-E-S-I-S. And it's just the insertion of a word in another word. And a whole nother is actually good colloquial English. That's the kind of thing that I'd say it's fine for the spoken word.
But don't write it.
No, I wouldn't want to.
All right. Let's take another call. Let's go now to Ann in Dallas. Hi, Ann.
Ann?
Yeah, hi, Ann.
What a great program. 60 years ago when I was in college, my English professor said that you would lend a book but get a loan from the bank. And today everyone says, I'll loan you the book.
Yes. Well, lend is the more traditional verb, but loan has been a verb for actually a couple of centuries, and it has kind of taken over lend. It's very precise and proper to use lend as a verb, but loan, let's see what I call it. It's probably stage 5, using loan for money. as, even though we talk about somebody who does it, not as a loner, but as a lender, don't we?
Hmm.
That's stage four, stage five.
I like that everything can be categorized. All right, Jeff Whittington has joined us again, Brian, which means, sadly, our time is coming to an end. But, happily, it is time to take another quiz and for Jeff and me to put ourselves at risk.
Chris, you're 6-for-6 right now, and I'm, I think, 2-for-6.
Which means that you're up for a victory.
Yeah.
Now.
In my defense, I didn't hear the anoint. I thought it was purloined because I was walking down the hall. So I just
if you'd started with a P, we would have known you were wrong.
Right. Okay. All right.
I thought you had done better than 2%.
No. I don't think so.
The second hour, the word choice quiz, first of all, what's the preferred form? And how about this, Jeff? We'll let you follow Chris.
So I can lie?
Well, no. So you can...
Okay.
All right. So what is the preferred form? Preventive or preventative?
You know, you make me question myself here. I always hear preventive medicine, but...
That's what I went with. I went with...
But you use something as a preventative. I guess I'd go with option B, preventative.
Actually, preventive is the preferred form.
All right, see, Jeff, now you're pulling ahead.
Yeah, the reason is the adjective follows the noun, and the noun is prevention, not preventation.
Oh,
so
okay.
So it's preventive. The plural of mother-in-law.
Mother's-in-law.
Mother's-in-law.
Yeah, it is, in fact, mother's-in-law. I was on an elevator.
I have two mothers-in-law, so I had to figure this out.
Ah, yeah. Well, I was on an elevator yesterday with somebody that I just overheard this conversation, and he said he owns a couple of hole-in-the-walls. And so it struck me, I wonder, should it be he owns a couple of holes in the wall? No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Or he owns a couple of hole-in-the-walls. I think that's one where you just would find a different way of writing it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Although if you're in the middle of a sentence, sometimes it's difficult. Now, this is a tricky one, and this is going to upset some listeners, I think. Only because they will realize that they've been getting it wrong for a long time. Let he who is without sin cast the first stone, or let him who is without sin cast the first stone.
Well, I was raised to say it the first way, but when I actually think about it, it makes more sense to say let him who is without sin cast the first stone.
And I chose he.
It should be him. Just as you would say let him go, him is the object of let. And the case of the pronoun is not affected by the fact that who is also is in the subjective case, but let him who is without sin cast the first stone. But if I'm not mistaken, in the King James Version of the Bible, it says he who is without sin, comma, let him cast the first stone.
Wow.
So that's what has thrown a lot of people off is the jiggering of that sentence.
See, I left who out and said he is without sin. That's how I was constructing it. But yeah. It's the let.
Yeah, it's the object of
gotcha.
Let. Now, three pronunciation terms. What? How do you finish cert in the phrase the Supreme Court granted cert? How do you pronounce the rest of that word?
Okay, first I'm going to spell it because that's I don't know that I've ever heard it pronounced. If I've heard it pronounced, I may have heard it incorrectly. Isn't it certiorari, right?
Yes.
Certiorari?
Certiorari?
No. Chris has it right.
Okay.
There are actually two pronunciations. Certiorari, which is what you gave it. And last week when Justice Scalia and I recorded our audio book, we agreed on certiorari as the way we would say it throughout the book. But there is another pronunciation that my beloved mentor, Charles Allen Wright, always used, which is certiorari, which is also considered quite proper. But very few people except old-fashioned law professors say certiorari. What is the flower that begins with glad?
I thought it was gladiola, but then I thought maybe it should be gladiolus.
I thought gladiola.
It is, in fact, one gladiolus.
Two
gladioluses. Gladioluses.
Oh,
but
wow.
People say gladiolas thinking they're that's actually a false.
Oh.
That's a false plural.
False plural.
So it's one gladiolus, two gladioluses. And if you look at a 1920 book, it would tell you to say gladioli.
Wow.
But I don't know any Texans who say that.
Gladialine.
Well, I will say it from now on.
Just buy some glads.
Yes.
And the Christmas flower that begins the poin.
I'm going to say silent I and say poinsettia.
Poinsettia.
The standard pronunciation throughout the country, preferred pronunciation, poinsettia.
Really?
Yes. And and leaving out that I is a linguistic syndrome called either syncope or haplology. Haplology. It's leaving out a syllable erroneously, and that's what's happening with poinsettia, which is, I think, stage three. But it's a regionalism, and I'm always careful to say poinsettia.
Growing up in the Northeast, lots of people said poinsettia, so I'm considering myself still, maybe it's stage three, but I'm beyond that.
My 33% average is you know, I've stayed true to 33%.
Yeah, I did much better in hour one. Well, Brian, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in and for bringing all this wisdom and all these books. It's been great to have you.
Thank you, Chris.
We are going to say goodbye to Brian now, but if you are interested in receiving any of the books that he's written that we've talked about throughout the 2 hours of the show today, you are welcome to do so by giving us a call now at 1-800-456-5372. Now Brian has a last point to make.
Oh, I just wanted to say, if anybody wants to get my usage tip of the day, which goes out, it's a listserv, you can get it on our website at www.lawprose.org.
Cute little pun.
We'll link to that as well. Thanks a lot, Brian.
Thank you.
Thank you. You can also make a contribution and receive a thank you gift, including several of Brian's books, at online at kera.org.
And Chris, we started the show today with two copies of Making Your Case that are autographed by both Brian Garner and Judge Justice Antonin Scalia. One of those is gone. So we have one copy remaining at the $500 level. That's the last one, and we have two copies of Black's Law Dictionary that are both autographed at the $350 level. This last autographed Scalia book is going to be a rare thing. I mean, I don't know that Justice Scalia gives out a lot of autographs.
Yeah, well, he's not in places where he's right. he's right. signing things.
Exactly.
And you know, again, we talked about this on a show recently, The Man Who Loved Books Too Much. There is a huge, not that you're obtaining this to go out and sell it or hang on to it and sell it, but there's a huge market for signed first editions. And in particular, with two authors of this magnitude, it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, so this is really, it's possibly your very last chance to get this at 800-456-5372.
Don't scare them.
You also have opportunity to pick up Garner's Modern American Usage. This has been very popular today at the $225 membership level. You can get that online at kera.org or on the phone at 800-456-5372. And at the $120 membership level today, we've got Garner on Language and Writing, which is a fantastic reference. I mean, I'm really excited about the show today, Chris. Y'all did a great job in here. It was very entertaining.
There's always a lot to learn when Brian comes, and he's such a good sport. I mean, he is an avowed snoot. What is it?
Snoot.
But really interesting and has a great sense of humor about everything and knows everything.
He does know everything.
Which is pretty impressive.
He really does. And if he has really great opinions, and like I've said many times today, I'm often opening up this Garner's Modern American Usage on Fridays. And I've even heard them reference it on Away With Words, the show that comes on after the Anything Show on Fridays, because it is such an internationally known reference, and he is such an internationally known expert on language and usage. So please show your thanks for Brian's time. I think he's got to catch a flight this afternoon, so he made special time to be here for 2 hours for the membership campaign by calling. Show your thanks by calling 800-456-5372.
You know, we didn't talk about this during the program, but the interesting thing about the other book we have available at the $120 level, Garner on Language and Writing, in that book he includes his retort to a lot of his critics in the world of lexicography and in the world of language use. He is important enough that people sort of take him on and argue with him in the public sphere, and he's written their criticisms and then his responses. It's a fascinating bit of reading if you're really interested in language and how it works and how the experts sort of debate and shape the way they form their opinions. This is a really fascinating book.
And the foreword in that one is by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So, you know, at the highest levels of law and writing, we've got expertise, and he is willing to listen to differences of opinion, and I think he's very fair. And what a great, what a great guest, what a great show. Hopefully you enjoyed it as well, and hopefully you're calling 800-456-5372 or going online to KERA.org in support of your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton.
You can make a contribution online at KERA.org, or you can call us on the phone at 1-800-456-5372. If you have a question, that may be the best place to get it resolved in terms of receiving particularly one of these autographed books. We want to thank everyone who has listened the past 2 hours. We have had phenomenal audience response. We also want to thank those of you who are calling to make a contribution at 1-800-456-5372. Thanks.
The team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.